again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been thinking for a long time that Jeanine Geske should be on the show with us because she is doing remarkable work, and she has been doing remarkable work for a long, long time. She, of course, was a state Supreme Court justice here in Wisconsin from 1993 to 1998. She served as distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School and director of what we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this hour, the law school's Restorative Justice Initiative. She has taken this mission all over the world. She has been to Canada, Belgium, Ireland, Turkey, Italy, South Africa, Peru, and she's just waiting. It hasn't come through yet for a visa, so she'll be able to go to Tehran this Sunday to talk about to talk to Iranian judges. She served on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, was also the interim Milwaukee County executive. I had forgotten about that. And, of course, was a justice on courts here in Milwaukee for a number of years. We're going to be talking about restorative justice with a special emphasis on the issues and the people that she has been working with. And I'm very interested in the work that she's doing all around the world. She has also written a great deal about voting right now in America, the voter ID, which I asked her if we could talk about. She said, okay. And also, I wanted to talk to her about whether or not we should continue electing Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin. And so we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Why in the world are you going to Iran? That's amazing. I mean, you're all over the world these days, Jeanine.
Well, I was invited by the law school at the University of Tehran. There's a law professor there in particular that's putting on a conference with some people from around the world that are doing restorative justice. And I find it interesting that the Iranian judges apparently are interested in that. And, of course, it's a country that still stones people and engages in some corporal punishment. But there are aspects of it, their law, that actually has pieces of restorative justice. For example, in a number of crimes, including very serious crimes, victims or family members of a victim have a say as to whether somebody gets executed.
Really?
Or not. And they very much want to involve the community and victims in their process in a way that we generally don't in our country. And so there are aspects of it. And I think that a lot of countries are looking to use restorative justice involving the victims on petty crimes and juvenile crimes because, you know, it doesn't make sense to incarcerate kids. And it's better to have them sort of understand the harm they're causing people and hopefully get them back into the community and help support them get straighten out and also have the victims feel like they're no longer afraid of these offenders. So restorative justice is a way to do that.
So let's talk about restorative justice. I read this Milwaukee Magazine article about you done a little while ago, and evidently when you were first asked to become involved in restorative justice, you said, no, I don't want to do this. Why? And now look at you, you're going all over the world.
Well, I have to say that I thought it was some liberal, wide-eyed idea. I thought, what victim would ever want to sit down face-to-face, which is what I first heard of, with an offender? And I was sitting in courts that had homicide cases and sexual assault cases, and I thought, holy mackerel, we're always trying to protect these victims in the courtroom. Why would we ever want to have them sit at a table and talk to an offender? And what I've learned, I started by being exposed to it in the prison. What I've learned is there are a lot of victims and survivors, as they want to be called, that really do want to have that dialogue with offender, even in very serious crimes, sometimes 10, 15, 20, even 30 years after the crime. Because the offender holds the answers to questions that often no one else can answer for the victim. And so I do those, and then I do other processes involving survivors and giving them an opportunity to tell the stories of the ripple effect and the harm that's been caused, and hopefully to affect the offenders and also the community to better understand what crime does to us.
Mm-hmm. And what about the criminals themselves? Do you find that the process can make them, I don't know what the right word is here, more sympathetic?
Yes, well, I'll talk about the prison program. The victims or survivors that we have speak there. There's when I first started, I had there was a woman whose husband was a police officer killed in the line of duty. I have another man from Milwaukee whose father owned a liquor store on the north side, and when he was 14, his father was shot between the eyes in an armed robbery. I have a drunk woman whose son was killed by a drunk driver, and I have a woman who was sexually assaulted while she was pregnant. And they all come and tell their stories in detail, like an hour and a half, sort of tell their lives of what happened during the crime, before the crime, during the crime, and after the crime. And I can tell you that even as a judge, I never heard a victim be able to tell their story like that, because we are objection at relevancy. And, you know, if somebody's losing sleep over the harm from a crime, we don't let them talk about it in the courtroom because it's not relevant, but it's relevant to them. And so victims get to tell their stories, and then we use a talking piece or other mechanisms for everybody to react and share. And I can tell you from the offender standpoint, there are two things that offenders think about when they hear these stories. One, they'll say they've never heard anybody describe a crime like that, even a victim. And they'll say, you know, in many cases, their victims, for example, in armed robbery, were basically faceless. All they thought about was they took some property at that moment. And they never thought that a week, a year, 2 years, 5 years later, this victim is still suffering from it. It's changed his or her life. Sometimes marriages break up. And they never thought about those ripples. And so they really do start thinking about the crime, the harm they do, as opposed to getting caught at some action. The other piece of it that's really remarkable when you work with both male and female offenders is most of them are also victims of crime as children. And so when these victims describe the depression they felt, the rage, even some cases wanting revenge, they identify with that because they understand that. And some of them realize that they never got past that rage is being taken out on innocent people because they saw their mother shot between the eyes, because they were raped when they were six years old. And so it's really a remarkable process with the high-end offenders, and that's why I'm such an advocate of using restorative justice in schools and with kids, because if we can do that with the smaller crimes, hopefully they'll never get to the point of being in prison.
So is it a stretch to say if many of those criminals had been able to tell their stories earlier on in some fashion, and I'm not sure what fashion they would do that, it would have kept them from becoming violent
themselves?
Well,
I think telling their stories and getting adequate support for it. We don't support and help our kids. You know, and I tell people that when you read an article in the newspaper about some kid who has been physically abused, sexually abused, kept in a cage, locked in a basement, and everybody has sympathy for that child, there's a good chance that that child will turn out to be the offender that people are calling names later on when they're an adult. And, you know, there are the miraculous stories where people come through that all right, but there are a lot of really hurting people out there that wind up hurting other people. So I think a combination of telling their story and getting the support and help they need when they've been victimized, that we wouldn't have so many offenders.
Mm-hmm. Have you done the same in the Catholic Church with abusers, with priests who have abused and their victims?
I have. Most of the work I've been doing in the church, and we talk about re-victimization, most of the priests and religious that were the offenders are dead, have dementia, or in denial. So there's very, you know, because it was so long ago, there are very few offenders who are capable or willing to do a face-to-face. But most survivors of clergy abuse will tell you the re-victimization by the institution of the church and the hierarchy in many ways was worse than the initial assault, because they turned to the church in many cases for support and help and felt deceived, in some cases even ignored, and the priests went on to abuse. So we've been doing a lot of work, and that's the work I've been doing in Ireland a number of times, going to do training so that survivors and parishes and people who've left the church and priests and bishops can get together and talk about the harm and that's happened here, and people can tell their stories, which are pretty profound and moving. I think once you've heard one of those stories, you never look at that issue the same way that you would if you just read about it in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. I've read that a lot of people have left the church in Ireland. Is that true?
Oh, the churches are almost empty in Ireland.
Is it really?
It's like 10% of the population is still going. And of course, the Catholic Church was very vibrant in Ireland. A friend of mine just did some work with 60 priests recently over a weekend to have them sort of telling their stories to each other. And they were talking about the loneliness and feeling like their whole vocation has collapsed. Now, these are priests that were non-abusers, but who feel, you know, the church is no longer there and they devoted their lives to it. And they feel deceived, too, by some of the things the hierarchy did. These are really profound issues. And there are a lot of people that have left the church over it, that were having issues with the Catholic Church. And I'm Catholic. I'm a practicing Catholic. But I certainly understand people's fear and unhappiness with decisions that were made by people in authority over these cases. And you know, so many more victims were harmed because of the decisions they made.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in something that you wrote or brought attention to. This goes into so many areas that restorative justice could be used to deal with the problem of gun violence in the city of Milwaukee. How so?
Well, I can tell you that one of the things we did for about 4 years was we were doing what we call these circles with a talking piece in neighborhoods, both on the north and south side, in some of the tough neighborhoods. And I'm just going to share a story. I was doing a circle up on at a place on Martin Luther King, and we had mothers who had sons killed. We had mothers whose sons were incarcerated. Mm-hmm. We had offenders. We had police officers. We had people in the community sitting in the circle. And with a talking piece, I asked the question, what impact has violence had on your life? And people told their individual stories. And one of the stories that was told was by a police officer. And he described being called to a shooting a number of years ago on the north side. And he was the first officer to respond. People were screaming and yelling. And he said, what happened? And they said, someone was shot in the house. And he describes in detail, I'm going to speed it up, but running up the steps with his gun out and walking in the living room and seeing a little two-year-old girl with a bullet hole in her head, gasping. And he talks about holstering his gun and picking up that child in his arms. And he said, it was like I was in a bubble because I could hear the screams and the sirens, and yet I was holding this little life, and she took her last breath in my arms. And he said, I've thought about her. I've dreamed about her. I've talked to doctors and nurses. Is there something I could have done? And then he looked at the circle of people that live in the neighborhood, and he said, I want you to know that every time I get called to a shooting in the city of Milwaukee, I take her with me. You know, and when people tell those stories, everybody in that circle felt differently about that police officer after he shelled that shirt. And, of course, people that live in that community all have their own stories, and whether it's, you know, their children potentially getting shot or their sons being convicted or burying somebody. There was one of the stories where some little children seeing some balloons at a house and quickly asking who died. Because although it was a birthday party, they associated balloons with a funeral of a child. And so you think, you know, it's important that all of us that live in this community understand that that's the circumstances people are living under. And I think if we can bring people together and talk about not whether or not, you know, you go to jail or you don't go to jail, but this is what's happening to children and seniors and people in our neighborhoods. And that's no way to live, you know, in a modern city where we have a lot of amenities. There are people living with that kind of heartache and pain and fear, and we ought to all try to understand that and do something about it.
Yeah, we don't look at it, do we? We really don't.
No.
Yeah. There's certain, I know you made mention of, I talked about the book Evicted, which really struck me that it's a neighborhood, you know, I drive through it all the time, and yet I didn't really know the stories. We don't know the stories.
Well, and that's what I love about restorative justice is we give people an opportunity uninterrupted to tell their story. Mm.
So it works, you're in a circle and people just talk.
We have a talking piece. Okay. So it's that's a Native American tradition. So you can either use a talking rock or a stick. The natives use things with a lot of symbolism on them. And the circle keeper, the facilitator, would ask a question. And so the question I asked in a lot of these circles was, what effect has violence had on you? And then I pass it to the next person, and they can share whatever story they want. So it can be, they live in a certain neighborhood because of violence. I mean, one man of color described how he can never run in the city of Milwaukee, because if he runs for a bus or he jogs, people are going to assume that he's running because of a crime. Mm. And it's those things that people, even people who had been convicted of crime, never thought about. Mm-hmm. That their actions are having that kind of impact of people in their own communities. And so each person tells your story uninterrupted. We had one young man who had been taken from his mother and put back with his mother when he was 7 on the north side of Milwaukee. And suddenly there was gunshots, and she pushed him to the ground to protect him. He was 7 years old, and she fell dead in front of him with bullets in her back. And, and we all look at him, and we understand, we don't condone, but we understand how he wound up in the system.
Right.
He was moved to Cabrini Green after that in Chicago, where we all know there was terrible violence. So as we learn each other's stories, police officers learn the stories of offenders learn, and neighbors hear the stories of police officers, we come together as a community, and then you work towards healing or ways to approach the issues, human to human. And I just think we just need more of that. We're in a world of them and us, whether it's politics, whether it's neighbors, a world of them and us.
Yeah.
And they do this, and we don't do that. And, it's this is our community, and it belongs to all of us.
So how should the idea of restorative justice, how can it find its way into the actual courtroom?
Well, for the most part, it is not an alternative to trial. It's not a mechanism for a fact finding. So if you have somebody who denies having committed a crime, they should go to trial. But you can use it as an alternative. And the district attorney's office in Milwaukee had a restorative justice unit that David Lerman, who unfortunately has passed away, started many, many years ago, where they have they do a small circle with community members and a victim if the victim wants to. And it's an alternative to going through the criminal justice system or a smaller offense. John Chisholm has used restorative processes that keep some kids, juveniles, out of the juvenile system. And so it can be used there. Now, I do the victim-offender dialogues that I was describing in Crimes of Severe Violence, and those are post-conviction, and those are really done for the benefit of the victim. They are all victim-initiated, and amazing. For some victims, they want to find a way to forgive. Others don't want to call it forgiveness, but they want some healing. They want to know answers.
Sure.
There's an amazing story about a woman that I know from Texas, and her daughter was brutally raped and murdered and tortured. And 18 years later, she and the daughter of the woman who was killed met with an offender. And one of the things they wanted to know from him is, what were her last words? Now, this was 18 years later. And he said, and he, very slow mentally, and he was high in drugs at the time, but he said, "I'll never forget. She looked up at us and said," because there were two of them, "I forgive you and God will forgive you." And she died. And the mother, who you can see her on the tape just weeping, said that brought her some peace to know her daughter was in a place of peace when she passed. So it's amazing. I mean, I met with another man whose daughter was killed by a drunk driver while she was a student at UW. And he said, "I knew I wanted to meet with the young man who did this. I wanted to make him a better person because I wanted to give meaning to my daughter's death." Hmm. I mean, I'm just honored to be with people that have that capacity and walk that journey with them. But it's amazing how much people are able to heal and move forward when they go through the process.
Hmm. And your law school students were learning restorative justice. Why is it important for the students to learn how to do this?
Well, when restorative justice really started in this country, it was primarily social workers that were involved in it and still are. But, the lawyers control the system, the legal system. Their district attorneys, their judges, their defense lawyers, and they need to understand that this is a more holistic way to approach some kinds of crimes or crimes in a certain way. And, you know, we're seeing more and more of that. I mean, even in federal court in Milwaukee, Judge Patricia Gorenz has a reentry court where she meets every week in sort of an informal setting with a prosecutor and a defense lawyer to talk to guys about, after they've come out of prison, what are you doing? Where are you looking for a job? You know, what's going on with the girlfriend? And they have a dialogue, but it's a connection to the court to make sure they're not going off and committing new crimes. And so all these problem-solving courts are another outgrowth of this, and we're seeing more and more of that because what we've been doing hasn't worked.
Yeah.
We've got 22,000 people incarcerated in the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, we still have crimes, and most of them are going to get out, and they don't come out better than when they went in. And so, you know, it's funny because you now see a movement of both people who are conservative politically, Republicans, the Koch brothers, and others moving towards, you know, revamping our system and finding better ways. What we've done hasn't been working, so we need to find a better way to do it. And I think this is a piece of it. It doesn't fix problems, but it makes people understand their role and responsibility as a community member, even if you've committed a crime.
And it seems to be internationally applicable, which is interesting, isn't it? You're doing it in Ireland. You're doing it all over the world.
Actually, the United States has been behind the times. Huh. It's in the UN documents. It's to be an EU country, you need to have some restorative justice. Canada uses a great deal of restorative justice, has for a long time. But more and more countries are, in fact, I was invited and couldn't go to Bahrain. They were doing a conference and trying to help the decision makers, the judges and the equivalent of court commissioners to understand what this is. It's a way of approaching harm to communities that doesn't involve putting someone in a cage, locking them up, and then letting them out at the end and having them worse than when they went in. And so countries in Belgium, for example, they've had a system of restorative justice availability for offenders and victims through their entire system, from the police station all the way to major convictions, for years and years. And they provide that opportunity for anybody who wants it. Germany, Austria, a number of other European countries have a lot of restorative justice. And so Australia, New Zealand early on was doing a lot of restorative justice. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of schools, Milwaukee Public Schools, and schools are doing, and with bullying and those kinds of issues, trying to get, you know, get these kids to talk to each other and hopefully find a better way to deal with conflict than hurting each other.
Yeah. Is there a way, I know you're Belgian, and we had a horrible terrorist attacks in Belgium recently and cells in Belgium. Mm-hmm. Is there an area in the world where restorative justice wouldn't work? Can you imagine taking one of those bombers and having him meet with a family member who had lost a family member in one of those bombings?
It's interesting. I think at one of the universities, it was the one that I taught at, Leuven in Belgium, actually has a $15 million grant with other European universities to look at border security and restorative justice. If you've got an offender who's willing to talk about it, you know, there were some of the victims of Timothy McVeigh that wanted to meet with him.
I remember that.
And yes. So, you know, it, again, I believe that it's a victim-initiated process. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't listen to the offender on those serious crimes until the victim came forward. But if the victim wanted to sit down and, you know, show a picture of the person that they killed, mm-hmm. talk about, you know, and the offenders we work with in the prisons don't get anything other than the feeling that they're giving back to the victim. They don't get any consideration for doing this. And so I certainly think, you know, in those cases, it might be very appropriate to do it. again, if the victim wants to. And there are a number of victims that have met with people on death row. Texas had a big program for a long time where surviving family members could meet with offenders on death row before they were executed and have that dialogue. And sometimes they talk about forgiveness and sometimes they don't. And it's really up to the victim as to what he or she wants to express.
Hmm. I remember interviewing years ago, I think it was the uncle of a young woman who died in Oklahoma City.
And from Milwaukee.
He was from Milwaukee, an amazing man. He went to meet Timothy McVeigh's mother, right?
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary story.
Right. And, you know, that's the other thing. The family members of offenders are often also deeply impacted and hurt.
Right.
I have a lot of family members of homicide victims that will talk about the family member of the offender who sat on the other side of the courtroom, like a bad wedding, right? The victim side and the family. And I've had parents of somebody who's been murdered say, I'd rather be the parent of the murdered child than the parent of the child who murdered somebody. And but there have been even meetings between parents, and that's been happening even in Israel-Palestine, where family members of whether it be a Palestinian soldier or whether it be an Israeli soldier that's killed somebody, that the families have gotten together, and there's an organization that does that work. And it's just humanizing people. I mean, when it comes down to it, we're all part of this human family, and if you believe in a religion, we're God's family, and it's a matter of trying to understand. It doesn't mean there shouldn't be consequences. It doesn't mean people shouldn't be incarcerated, but it's a deeper understanding of the harm that's caused, and it isn't just about breaking the law.
Yeah. Jeanine Geske is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for her. We're talking about restorative justice. We'll branch into other areas as well, but she has a long, long distinguished career as a judge, also as a professor, and she's now taking the restorative justice work that she's done, very important work here in the state of Wisconsin. She's taken it all over the world. She was a state Supreme Court justice from 93 to 98, interim Milwaukee County executive, served as distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School, director of the law school's Restorative Justice Initiative, and she is hopefully going to be going to Iran on Sunday of this week if her visa shows up in time. But she's taken this mission all over the world, Canada, Belgium, Ireland, Turkey, Italy, South Africa, Peru, and worked with the Catholic pre-sexual abuse issue and many other important issues. She's seen a lot, hasn't she? And worked in some, done some very, very important work. So we welcome your phone calls. Should we have more of this in our criminal justice system? She just brought up so much. Take whatever piece of it wherever you would like to go. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Is there a way for us to hear from people in the community? It seems like it's just so important for people to tell their stories. Is there a way for us to understand each other better by having these kinds of sessions? She's talked about ensuring that someone knows that he or she has truly been heard and understood when it comes to victims of and perpetrators of violent crime and people who have been terribly wronged. It seems as though there ought to be a more prominent place for this in our justice system. What do you think? We'll take your phone calls in just one moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Jeanine Geske and to Lynn in Eau Claire, our first caller for you. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen and Jeanine. I, at one time, was a victim of domestic abuse. A lot of women are. My home issues have resolved, but I was beaten up and then I was arrested. And it follows you. It's bad enough being victimized. It's bad enough trying to get your life back in order. But because I have a domestic, I can't read to my grandchildren in school. I can't go on field trips. We've resolved our issues here. But why? And this is, I'm not the only one by any stretch of the imagination. Are women further victimized for being victims.
Well, I'm sorry that you had that experience, and obviously I can't speak to your case because I don't know specifically what happened. You know, what's interesting is that in a lot of cases, well, generally people have said restorative justice shouldn't be used in domestic violence because of the imbalance of power and for other reasons. But so many survivors of domestic violence and relationships wind up going back together. It doesn't sound like you did. And actually, we at Marquette University in November 10th and 11th this fall are going to explore the issue of restorative justice and domestic violence because it's a complex issue. And, you know, the convictions, obviously, of the conviction you have has caused you a lot of pain, and it certainly can cause pain on both sides. And maybe there are better ways, at least in some cases. And in some cases, convictions may be the right way to go. But I know the advocates in Milwaukee are really looking at trying to say, should we try to facilitate some kind of dialogue along with treatment before people go back into these relationships? So I'm sorry you've had such a negative experience, though.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry, too, Lynn. Thanks for your call. Abraham in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I was going to say that we are way, way overdue for a restorative justice system in this country. Over the years, I've noticed that our justice system is more about vengeance than about anything. And what at the end of the day happens is somebody commits a crime, whether it's a minor crime or a major crime, they go to prison. And they come out worse than they were, and the most enraging thing about it is that society is really worse off with this system than it would be with a restorative justice system, because you know you put somebody in prison, you ruin their record, and when they come out, they really can't do most of the things that are a necessity for our way of life. And so I'd just like to say thank you to your guest. I can't remember what her name was.
Janine Geske.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the comment. And, you know, one of the things that working with a lot of victims is that if they've been victimized, they live in fear that the offender was going to come out and re-victimize them. They're going to find their house again. And that's rarely the case, but a lot of victims have that legitimate fear. And for victims who are willing and want to have a conversation with the offender, they'll soon have those fears allayed and realize that that's not going to be the case. And so both the victim and the offender, as well as the community, can benefit. So I appreciate your support for the work.
I think that maybe I was not hearing him correctly, but it seems to me as though he was also suggesting that there are a lot of people who are in prison who shouldn't be in prison. Do you agree?
Well, most of the people that are in prison in Wisconsin, although we often talk about the drug-related offenses, have also wound up committing violent offenses. But often those offenses were committed because of a drug habit. And so we've got this circular problem. I think that we have thought that was the only way to be safe, and I don't think that's the only way to be safe. I think that we can do things, supervising them in the community, having them understand their responsibility, and also encouraging them to give back to the community. You know, it's funny because when you give people a chance to do good, you actually see the excitement in their lives, you know, and I know that some neighborhoods are doing that in Milwaukee. They're trying to engage young offenders or young members of the community in gardens and those kinds of things, maybe doing actually good works of goodwill in their communities, and they feel good about it. The community feels good about it, keeps them busy, and I think that we just need a different approach. So in that sense, I don't think we gain anything by locking them up for periods of time and then releasing them, and the rehabilitation programs, we've really shrunk those back, and then we don't want nobody wants to hire them when they get out. That's the other problem. You know, we don't want to hire offenders. Well, if you don't hire offenders, you're going to expect that they're going to recommit crimes because they have to support themselves somehow.
Yeah. So. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we go to Judith in Grand Marsh next. Hi, Judith.
Hello. Thank you always for your programs. I've never heard a better speaker on this subject. And years ago, she addressed my daughter's commencement at Muskego High School. And I can't say I remember the details, but it's the same feeling I have listening to her today. She has such a wonderful woman's voice, full of commitment and strength and knowledge and fairness and her compassion. Every time I see her name or hear her name, I have the feeling of those words, and it was the sense of what I got at her commencement address, even though in my aging brain I can't remember the title or, you know, a sentence or anything else. But I remember it was wonderful, and God bless you for your work, and it's so important to have a strong woman's voice, and you're just a wonderful speaker on anything I've heard you talk about. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. You've made my day.
And you've refreshed her memory, too, which is really a good thing. A good thing. Our number is 800-486-8655. You know, when you were talking, Janine, about what you've seen and what you've heard, it's a lot of tough issues. A lot of some horrible things have happened to human beings. What does that do to the way you view the world? I mean, do you see us as all potentially good, or do you think that there's a strong element of evil in the world? You've seen some terrible things, heard about them.
Well, you know, when people ask me that question, and, you know, maybe this comes a little bit from the time I was a judge, but I kind of look at my work in the way that I look at doctors who do oncology, pediatric oncology, you know, you're dealing with some really tough situations. But what you can do is try to make them better. And, you know, whether it's, you know, have a victim feel more comfortable or a survivor, be able to prevent a crime, to make a difference in the future. There are some awful things that people do to each other. And, you know, and there are people that need to be locked up. I'm not advocating that we open the prison doors. But I think we can do this so much better, and really particularly with the children, and to save our young people so that we're not having these huge numbers of incarcerated young men for the most part, but young women as well. And so, I just see such promise in this work. I mean, I've just seen miraculous things as people reach out. One of the stories I like to tell is we were doing a circle on the South Side, and there was a young man talking about that he was getting out of prison again, and he knew he wouldn't get a job, and he really wanted to get some insurance so he could have his child stay with him. And he said, but I know it's not going to work, and I'm probably going to return to crime. And there was an older police officer in the circle, and he went up to him afterwards and said, you know, I'm not going to give you a pass on what you've done, but I understand how you got where you got. And if you are serious about wanting a job, you come see me at the police station, and gave him his card. The guy showed up a couple of weeks later, and the police officer said, you know what? I want to make sure you're going to show up at a job. I want you here at 8:30 for the next 3 weeks every day, because I want to know you're going to show up for a job. To make a long story short, he appeared. Both the community prosecutor and the police officer started calling employers. They found an employer that would interview him. The police officer and the prosecutor went with him to the interview. The cop said to the employer, I really think you should hire him. He talked him into hiring him and said, look, if you have a problem, call me. And he gave him his card. And the guy was employee of the month a bunch of months.
And it worked out. That's great.
You know, and the guy had never had a job. And that's how it's supposed to work.
Right.
That we start understanding each other, and if people are sincere about wanting to work, that we give them a chance.
Yeah. Thanks, Judith, so much for your call. And Jervis in Milwaukee. Hi, Jervis.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I know who this is.
Oh, you do? You know him?
Hi, Ms. Gieske.
Hi, Jervis. I'm good. He's one of my survivors that speaks at the prison.
Ah.
I appreciate
one of my favorite
I
just, people.
I just called in because I just have to thank her publicly, I guess, for how, you know, my experience going through a victim offender dialogue and going through her program and talking at the prisons has transformed me. Because, and I've said this to Ms. Getsky herself in front of others, I thought the woman was crazy doing this kind of stuff, and I just, you know, could not see that. But after going through it, we have to come up with a different way in order to help people who do stupid stuff in a moment, you know. And sometimes they do a few moments of it, they'll do it over and over again, but at some point in time, we're going to have to change the way we our criminal justice system approaches things.
So tell me, how you went through the program, the law school program?
What I went through was I went through the where I had a dialogue with the one of the individuals who was involved in the murder of my father back when I was 13 years old. So and I think we did that back in 2012, I believe. And it was a life changing experience for me.
Wow!
And we're working on the next one. There's another individual involved, and it was a very powerful meeting between Gervison and the man who was in prison. And it was a privilege to be part of the journey.
And what happened when you met him? If you don't mind my asking,
I'm sorry. What was your question?
What happened when you met him?
You know, it was one of these things where I was prepared either way. You know, to be totally honest, I had a weird sense of compassion for him because, and then when we sat down and talked for roughly 2 hours, 2.5 hours, or however long we talked, I came to an understanding that he's a dummy. Now, and I tell people all the time, there's not going to be this kumbaya kind of thing where I'm going to have a, you know, sit down and I'm going to invite him over to my house when he gets out. No, that's not the issue. The issue is that I have an understanding of how he got to where he was, and I got an understanding of my father's last moments on earth. I mean, it's kind of hard to go into a lot of detail in this short amount of time.
Yeah.
But it's a life-changing experience, and it isn't for everybody. I'm not going to say it's for everybody, but, you know, if a person really wants to let go of some baggage, you know, it helped me let go of a lot of baggage. So,
thank you, Gervis.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the call. And you must have all kinds of stories like that at this point.
It's amazing. I mean, for me, it's just a privilege. It's like a journey that you travel with these survivors and to have their questions answered. And, you know, and sometimes I'll say to a family member, what if the answer is the worst possible answer you could think of? And they'll say, I've already thought about it. I've thought about everything, all the possibilities. I just need to know what happened. And often the only person that has the answer is the person that pulled the trigger, or particularly in homicides. And people get answers. And that in itself is healing. And there are questions like, what do you do on the anniversary of the murder? You know, I go to the graveside and I put flowers. And almost every offender will say, I'm very aware of that day. I look at the clock. I don't want to get out of bed.
Really?
And even hearing that is healing to a victim, that they're not just sitting watching TV, not caring when the surviving family member is suffering, but in fact, the offender is aware of that. And to have that dialogue, because those two lives are interlocked, whether they like it or not, because of the death that happened or the crime that happened. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your call. Keith in Madison is next. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yes, I was reading a story today about some young man in Chicago who was killed by a police officer. He's only 16 years old. He had plans to be an engineer, and he had great intentions, but somehow he got in with the wrong people, and things went downhill from there. I think what we should do, rather than trying to solve these problems on the back end, we should be addressing these things on the front end before people even get to prison.
Right.
We need to have jobs for everybody at a good living wage. We should provide health care for everybody. We should provide people with psychological counseling if they need it. But the problem is when they come out of prison, they're broken people. You're trying to turn around people who are damaged and broken. And I think by then it's too late. Unless there's some level of material support where they can draw on, it's almost too late. You can't do this. And I have a criticism for the body politic. We need to be a little more compassionate and look at people who fall through the cracks with a little more compassion, and look at people and say, but for the grace of God, go I. Because it could be anybody, any one of us.
That's one of the things the people that come to prison with me, including the survivors, will say, You know, it could have been me, could have been my son, could have been my nephew, you know, and, you know, I agree with you about, you know, the body politic or politicians. They ask us to be compassionate towards them for errors they've made and things they've done. And I agree that, you know, we have to find a way that if somebody is truly remorseful and wants to make amends and go ahead, that we support him or her in that, because we'll all benefit from it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I've been thinking as you've been talking about the potential possibilities for this, too. I mean, this country is such a mess with nobody's listening to anybody about anything politically, or the court's not working very well. The state Supreme Court in the state of Wisconsin, I mean, they're down each other's throats on things. No, people aren't listening to each other. It should go lots of places, don't you think?
Oh, well, I kind of laugh. There's that old expression that when you have a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. For me, the whole world needs a circle. I always say that. but I do think, you know, if people could listen to each other's stories, you don't have to necessarily agree with them, but you could understand how they came to the view or the experience that they had. You know, and I when he was describing the shooting of the young man by the police officer, one of the thoughts that crossed my mind, obviously the pain of the parents and the relatives of the young man that was killed, but that police officer is suffering as well. And it's not as though taking someone's life is something that doesn't deeply impact an officer. And so, you know, we all assume that he goes merrily on his life, even if he gets his job back. And people forget about the family members of the young person that was killed. And there's a lot of pain. And there are ways that we as community members ought to be able to support that pain to help them.
Yeah. I want to talk to you. I told you I just wanted to reserve a few minutes here because you were a state Supreme Court justice. I know you were on Micah Shea's show yesterday calling for appointment of justices instead of election money. It's hard to imagine the amount of money that's going into justice elections, and it seems kind of jarring in a way to even think about the kind of money that's going in for justice, right?
Well, it's the money that's going in. It's the nature of the ads. I mean, our court has held that those ads can be deceptive, that it's all right if they're deceptive. So people aren't even getting good information. The ads really have nothing to do with the agendas of the people putting the money into it. That, you know, they pick the crime ads. And then many of the entities that are funding these campaigns also have matters in front of the court. And so people don't trust decision-making by the court when so much money has been spent. And, you know, I know the people on the court, and I believe they have integrity. But the point is, if people can't trust it, then our justice system falls apart, because people have to have faith in the court. And, you know, and I, one of the things I said is, I think, and I know this, that a lot of people who are highly qualified, would make great justices, are not going to run. They're not going to put their families and their own reputations through what happens in these races. And, you know, again, not to impugn the people that have done it, but there are lots of people that it will not, whereas if we had an appointed process, I think we would get more candidates and a wider choice of people to choose from. It has its problems, the appointed process, but it can't be as bad as what we have now.
So how does that happen? How do you change it?
Well, there are, usually there's a panel, and Governor Walker has a panel, but the panel that Governor Walker has, which is not unusual, are all his appointees. So you do a panel, and different states have differently. Maybe they have 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats, or maybe, like where we have a Republican governor, maybe 7 Republicans and 6 Democrats, and then maybe a few community members or the deans of the law school or other people. And people apply, and that commission goes through and looks at people's qualifications. They debate it, they interview them, and then they give a list to the governor, 3 people, 4 people, 5 people, depending on the process, and the governor appoints somebody on the list. Now, it's interesting, Judge Rick Brown, who's a retired Court of Appeals judge in Waukesha, looked at a system, and he proposed that 80% of the commission would have to recommend somebody before the name name went forward. So it would have to be some bipartisan support. And then the question is whether they stay appointed for life or you know, without an impeachment, or whether you put them on a ballot every 10 years and people can either say qualified, not qualified. And if they, by a certain percentage of people say not qualified, then the governor makes another appointment. That's called the Missouri plan. Huh. The problem with that is that special interests, where the states that have those special interests have also put in a lot of money at the end, you know, in very partisan groups on both sides, have defeated candidates, you know, and they aren't even running against a real candidate. So there are problems with all the systems, and certainly it can be partisan with an appointment process, but these brutal ads and the deceptive ads and then the influence of money potentially on decisions, I think, is so detrimental to an independent, impartial third branch of government.
Thank you so much for being with us. I hope there are many, many more circles, and I think there will be. Who knows? I hope you can get to Tehran.
I do, too. I know.
It's getting close.
<see. laughs>
Yeah, thank you. Jeanine Geske, our guest this hour. She is a remarkable person, distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School, recently retired, but she's doing these restorative justice programs literally all over the world. She was on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court from 1993 until 1998. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 1 until 3, so I hope you'll stay with us. News from National Public Radio is coming up momentarily, and then many more interesting conversations.